Improving Society in less than 30 minutes. The short podcast of Körber Stiftung. How does the brain work? A reoccurring question out of fascination for and complexity of the brain. Yet we know so little. However, sometimes we experience a breakthrough in research. Just like when Aaron Schumann found out how and where proteins are built in neurons. A discovery that has changed the way we look at neurons and that was honored by the Körber European Science Prize 2024, which is endowed with 1 million euros. Aaron Schumann is director at the Max Planck Institute for Brain Research in Frankfurt. And today she talks about why she became a neuroscientist, how her research helps people with brain diseases, and why she uses part of the prize money to support social and engagement projects. Improving Society with Aaron Schumann. Moin. Well, hello.
Hello.
You've got nerves. Well, quite literally, your research is all about the nervous system. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about your research and try to make it so that a 10-year-old would understand.
Okay. So the nervous system, or the central brain, is made up of cells, just like all the rest of our body. But the nervous system cells, the neurons, as they are called, are very different from all the other cells in our body. So most of us who have seen pictures of cells know them as sort of round ball-shaped structures. Mm-hmm. And the brain cells have that round ball shape to them, but they also have these very elaborate processes, or almost like little hairs that come off of them. And in fact, that's the most important part of the neuron. That's the part of the neuron that's important for its connections with all the other cells in the brain.
Like a cable.
It's like lots of cables coming out. It's the wires, more or less, in a network. And those wires are where that cell makes connections with all other cells. And it does that at a specialized contact point or junction that's called a synapse. Mm-hmm. And what we're interested in is how that individual brain cell or neuron functions as a unit, because it has an enormous volume. And most of the volume isn't in the round part of the cell that we know a lot about from all other cells in the body. Most of its real estate is actually in the cables. And so we need to understand how those cables function, how they get all of the goods and resources they need to keep the network going, but also how they get the goods and resources they need to change the network, to change the way the neurons talk to one another.
And there is this gap, and alongside with this gap, there are some substances. And at the moment, a lot of people are talking about proteins. The Nobel Prize has just been released, and it was also about proteins. And you are now recognized. You have won the Körber Prize. Congratulations from my side, by the way. What have you discovered? Can you try to tell us a little bit more about this, about those proteins?
Yes. So just like in all other cells, in brain cells, proteins are really the principal drivers of function. Mm-hmm. So everything the cell does is driven by these building blocks, which are the proteins. And going back to the analogy I made earlier about the simple cell and the rest of the body, if we think about how proteins are made in cells, in those simple cells, we know that the machines, which are called ribosomes, which make proteins, mm-hmm. are present in the cell body. Now, if you think about that volume I described, we know that a single neuron probably contains around 30 billion proteins.
Wow.
And then you think about the little round part of the cell and that having to supply the protein for that enormous amount of cable. It's essentially impossible. So what we have been working on and what we discovered almost 30 years ago now was that the protein synthesis machines and the templates, the blueprints for making the proteins, mm-hmm. are actually coming in a large part from the wires themselves. So those machines and the templates are transported out to those junctions, the synapses, mm-hmm. and the proteins can then be made there, very close to where they're needed, on demand.
And the way I understand is what we thought was they would be produced by the core of the cell, but you discovered it's not. It's actually where it's needed.
Exactly. That's correct.
What is the advantage of that?
Well, there's a couple of things. One is that the template can be used over and over. So if you want to minimize shipping costs, it would make sense to ship the blueprint out locally. Let's say that blueprint could make 100 copies of a protein. So you get one shipping cost to send the template. Whereas if you made the protein in the cell body centrally, you would need to pay 100 shipping costs to ship each individual protein out. So there's that advantage in terms of the cost of transport, but then there's also the advantage of supply and demand. So the synapse knows what it needs. It can locally, by talking to the protein synthesis machinery, get what it needs instead of having to basically make an order and send it back to the cell body and then wait for that order to be delivered. And hopefully there would be no mess up in the delivery and it would go to the right address and all of that, those things. So there's an economy that you get in terms of energy, but then there's also a control that you get by allowing the synapse to decide when and where it needs protein.
That sounds very reasonable. However, when we look back those 30 years, you did start your research against the mainstream, so against the current beliefs, especially as a woman. How did that feel and why did you pursue that?
It's an interesting sociology to reflect on, you know, how science is done. And I think at the time when we started those experiments, it made sense. People had most of what we know about how cells work comes not from brain cells, but from many cells that are have been the kind of workhorse of scientists that are big cells, they're easy to grow in the lab. And so most of what we understand about how cells works comes from those cells. So when you think about people trying to adopt an understanding of how cells work to the special morphology of neurons, it made sense. Oh, we just copy that idea and we just copy paste that cell body. We put it on top of the neuron and all of the machines that the cell needs are just in that round ball part of the cell. And so I guess people didn't think much about the numbers. They didn't think about the huge demand that was required by all of those wires. And it was just perfectly fine to think of it that way. So as you intuit, you know, that's what the textbook said. So we did our experiments that basically told us we were doing experiments way out in the wires, you know, very far away from the cell body. And we saw that the synapses we were measuring needed protein right away. So if we blocked the machine, the ribosomes, we saw that the synapses started to malfunction. And it was just a matter of timing that it was impossible for the proteins that they were getting to be coming from so far away because we could see this immediately. And so we interpreted the experiments and did more experiments to show that the protein synthesis was coming from this local site. And the reaction of, I would say, everybody was, oh, wow, but that's crazy. Isn't that silly? There was some history. So Ozzie Stewart, who was doing very high resolution imaging to visualize synapses, had seen using an electron microscope evidence for the protein synthesis machines near synapses. And he had pursued this and a few people picked up on it, but it had not really become mainstream. So he was working a bit on his own. And so some people even said, oh, you're picking up on that crazy idea of, you know, Ozzie Stewart. But I would say for me, it was such an interesting idea. And the more we thought about it, the more it actually made sense. It made a lot more sense than what was in the textbooks. And it was kind of fun to be going up against the dogma. There's something very energizing about it, I would say, when I think back on it. And there was just a fascination with what this presented as a problem. You know, it's really a logistics problem, right? It's how do you get the goods to the right place that we found really fascinating. And of course, there was so much to do. It just was a very captivating area to pursue.
It's very inspirational how you talk about it, given the fact that it's such a long time ago. Quite funny, the side note is that you've gotten your bachelor's in 1985 at the University of Southern California. And I was born in that year and studied psychology about 25 years
Oh,
later.
I feel so young.
So the question is, how did you get into the place of researching on neurons in the first place?
As you say, I was interested in psychology. I was actually originally interested in doing medicine, but at the time I thought, well, if I'm a medical doctor, I'll just be making diagnoses and fixing things. So I thought this rather mechanical, almost like a car mechanic, you know, seeing what's wrong and fixing it. Rather an incorrect portrayal of what medical doctors do. But nevertheless, that's how the way I thought about it at the time. I realized that what I wanted to do was do research and discover things. And I was particularly interested in learning. So how it is that we learn, mm-hmm. acquire information, and how we remember. And as my senior thesis undertook a twin study, there's a field of behavioral genetics that takes advantage mm-hmm. of the comparison between identical and fraternal twins. So two individuals that share 100% of their genes, more or less, and individuals that share only 50% of their genes. And by comparing the similarity in their cognitive traits and their genetic similarity, you can make attributions about how much of that cognitive ability comes from genes or from environment, nature or nurture. Mm-hmm. And so I did a study of learning and memory ability in these young twins in Southern California. I was working with a new assistant professor, so I was really given a lot of independence. But it was a hilarious experience. I was driving my car around Southern California, visiting the homes of twins to measure their learning and memory ability in their homes. Happened to be in an area of Southern California that was relatively new and very homogeneous. And so I felt as if I was in some kind of film noir setting with young twins that look the same, entering households that look the same, yeah. a little bit of an odd experience. And also, as an undergraduate, designing my own experiments, contacting the subjects, driving myself to their homes, yeah. analyzing the data. It was just too many moving parts for me. The experimental subject was already uncontrollable. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I couldn't actually do the testing because they were having a meltdown or whatever. So I just almost reflexively thought about simpler systems and went, you know, to the absolute other extreme when I decided what I wanted to do for my PhD, which is, you know, I ended up working with an invertebrate animal, mm-hmm. I think, responding to the chaos of working with those young human twins.
We are coming more and more into the medical applications of your work. We're coming from the psychology and behavioral pattern and the memory function. Now, obviously, it would be very interesting to know, what practical consequences do you see of your findings on protein synthesis in medicine?
There are lots of ways to answer that question, but let's just say that we are interested and we study and we're discovering how proteins are supplied at synapses. Mm-hmm. And we know that a functioning brain is absolutely required for everything that humans do. Basic functions like eating, breathing, sleeping, but also the more advanced functions like learning, being able to store information and use that information, being able to form memories. You know, the things that we think of as uniquely human are memories of the past, cumulative life experience. The richness of that is what makes us human. And of course, that has to be stored, right? Our sense of self has to be stored. Those memories have to be stored. And what we know is that memories are stored, at least in part, by changing the strength of communication between brain cells. So by changing the synapse, making it stronger or weaker. And we also know that in order for the synapse to change, that it needs to remodel itself. And the way it remodels itself is by changing the building blocks. So just in the same way you would remodel a house or let's say build an extension on a room, you would need more building blocks. In the same way, a synapse needs more building blocks or different building blocks. And those are the proteins. So synapses need proteins to function, but they also need proteins to change and to store memories. So what we're studying then is fundamental for understanding how synapses work. Now, when we think about human diseases and we think about all the different categories of human diseases, there are, for example, neurodevelopmental disorders like autism, mm-hmm. where we don't know a lot, but we do know that it's likely that there are wiring problems. So the wiring diagram of the brain is messed up so that the appropriate connections between cells are not made, or they're not made in sufficient quantity, or they're made too much of one type and too little of another type. And when we look at what we know about the individual mutations in humans that drive those defects, one striking thing, at least for for autism and all of the autism spectrum disorders is that most of the, what I would call heavy hitter genes that drive these diseases code for proteins that are present at synapses. So you have a huge category of human diseases that basically focus our attention when you say what's driving that disease on these synaptic proteins. And for many of those synaptic proteins, we know that their template or their messenger RNA is out at the synapses. So these proteins, either there's too much or too little of them, which means that their levels are what we call dysregulated. They're out of sync. So that tells us that the very thing that we're studying could shed a lot of light on this class of diseases. But what's interesting, it's not just these neurodevelopmental disorders, but neurodegenerative disorders. So in the last 15 years, there's just been this kind of striking convergence across all different kinds of brain disorders that these turn out to be problems of the network and therefore problems of the synapse. And that means
rather than the cell.
Yeah, rather than the cell, rather than, oh, a DNA molecule or some other thing. So this really brings the core business end, what I, at least from my perspective, the synapse is the, you know, the core business of what the brain cell does. It puts this area into focus. And it means that if we can really understand the proteins that are present at synapses, how they're supplied, how they're turned over, then we can tell what goes wrong in disease, right? So just like if you wanted to fix a car and you took it to me, I don't know anything about cars, and you told me my car doesn't work, I would not go in and try to fix the car without understanding how the engine works or how the mechanics of the car. So I want to make the point here also that it's very important to really understand the fundamentals before you try to go in and fix something, or at least that's an enlightened way of going about fixing something. So there's that aspect where having this very basic information is important. But not only that, as we've tried to understand the basic information, we've developed tools that allow us to really measure with great detail the proteins that are present at synapses. So what that means is that we can now ask what's wrong in diseased brains, because we can take advantage of different rodent models where they copy the human mutation into the mouse or the rat. Mm-hmm. And these animals then develop a rat or a mouse version of the disease. And we can measure the synapses of those animals. And we can say, oh, well, we can see that there's a problem because this one protein is not synthesized correctly. It's not actually being made at all at these synapses, or it's being made way too much. We're missing something that would normally dampen down the synthesis of this protein. So we'll be able to understand all of the components in these disease states.
Yet we still know so little about the brain, and you are helping us to understand more and more. And the way I see it is we're not losing our nerves, but we're losing the way to communicate between them. And the question that I'm dying to ask is obviously, what can we do about it? Can we, for example, eat more proteins? Is that or eat more omega-3 or amino acids? No, obviously joking, but what is helpful? Is there anything I can do as a person?
Just like you, I'm tantalized by those reports of, you know, the smart drinks and the, you know, eating more salmon every week, hoping that it's going to help my brain. But I would say, and this is only my personal opinion, that when I have really scratched the surface at looking at the science of some of that stuff, I'm not convinced by it. Right. You know, that is not to say that we shouldn't have a healthy lifestyle. There are lots of benefits. And there are, I think, a lot of data, particularly on dementia and Alzheimer's disease, that leading an active intellectual life and listening to this podcast, for example, is a good way of staving off the onset of dementia. So there are, I think, behavioral things we can do for dementia, but I don't know about dietary things. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if we look to the just released Nobel Prize winners, we heard about AI that might help to, you know, kind of unblock those building blocks or understand how the protein works. And also we know from, you know, like the vaccine of COVID, for example, that we need proteins in some other ways. How can new technologies and understanding more about it help?
The prizes in both physiology or medicine and chemistry are really perfect they really affect the work that we do. So one, the Physiology or Medicine Prize is on the regulation of protein synthesis, basically. So yeah. microRNAs that were identified by Ambrose and Rufkin actually bind to the template for proteins, the messenger RNA, and prevent that messenger RNA from being made. Mm-hmm. So just to come back to the disease example, it could be the case that in some of those proteins that are mutated in autism spectrum disorders, what is mutated is the ability of the microRNA to actually bind to the template and prevent the protein from being made. So now you have a loss of inhibition and you would get way too much of this protein present at synapses. That's a direct way that that prize influences synaptic proteins. And then the other prize, the prize for chemistry for AlphaFold and actually for David Baker's protein prediction, is also super germane in this sense, because one of the things that it allows us to do is to actually, with not much information, intuit what these complexes are. So I've been talking about the proteins as if they work in isolation, but in fact, you know, they're all components of even bigger complexes. And we can identify, let's say, the protein synthesis machine, the ribosome. We can visualize that, but we don't necessarily know what's decorating the ribosome, which is basically influencing its activity. It's telling it whether it should make a protein from a given template or not. And things like AlphaFold can be used to, guess isn't the right word, but basically decipher what mm-hmm. those regulators are. Everybody who's talking to the ribosome, we can and will use in our future experiments.
So the nervous system needs a well-functioning network, and so does research and scientists. So I love how you just backed up the new findings. And I also love how you've been an advocate for the involvement of young people. How did that come about, and why do you put so much time and energy into those social causes?
I mean, I think anyone who's done my job, or most people that you like and would like to talk to who have done my job, will tell you that one of the coolest things about running a research lab is all of the smart young people that you get to interact with over the years. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's something that you never think of when you're young. When you dream of having your own lab, you never think, oh, that will be so fun, I'll have all these smart young people. But it really is an amazing privilege, because everyone brings their own culture and their own ideas and their own background. And I love hearing all the different stories and their histories that have brought them to where they are. And besides the people who work with me directly, I think it's very important for us to inspire the next generation, because I think that science is a bit at risk. It's not well represented all the time in the curriculum of schools, and it's not necessarily presented in the best light. Like mm-hmm. I would say a lot of times the kinds of biology that people see in high school is more of a turnoff than a turn on. Mm-hmm. I remember my biology classes, we were dissecting dead organisms that where everything was the same color. It had been treated with formaldehyde. It stank. Mm-hmm. I was disgusted. Mm-hmm. I was absolutely disgusted by it. I was not excited by it. So I think it's very important to let young people know how science really works. And when we came to Frankfurt, our kids went to the international school, and I was on a committee there. And there was a young woman who was interested in biology and was telling me something that was a little bit naive. And I said, hey, you should come on over, you know, come over to my lab. I'm a scientist. And it was actually she or her that inspired this program that we started, which was the Max Planck Junior Scholars Program, where students apply and they come over and they do an internship and they work side by side with scientists. And it's been very inspirational. We have followed up with many of the students, and it really was kind of a life changer for them. It changed their trajectory. It changed what they wanted to do. They saw research in action. They see it as a human endeavor, right? I mean, it's actually a lot of fun in the lab, not just doing your own experiments, but the lab culture can be a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And so it's important for them to see this and to see it firsthand.
Yes. Currently, you are the director of the Max Planck Institute for Brain Research, and the Kerber Prize aims to honor outstanding scientific findings and researchers. So the prize money is 1 million euros. And obviously, I need to ask you the question, what do you plan to do with that money?
there's a component where we're going to study these disease synapses, which I'm very excited about. So in the lab, we've recently figured out or optimized a pipeline that was developed by someone in France to isolate individual synapses from cell types. And with this, we've gotten a lot of really fine-grained and beautiful information about the templates and the proteins that are present at synapses. And so now we're in a position to do the experiment I was discussing, which is to ask what's wrong with synapses and disease. So we're going to begin with three different disease models and look with this great method to understand what's wrong with these synapse types in a way that no one's been able to do that before. Most of the money is for that. And then kindly, Kerber has also thought about outreach. Mm-hmm. So what we're going to do is to run an outreach program that targets kids in Frankfurt that may not have the typical junior scholar program on their radar. We want to target underrepresented groups, places in Frankfurt with a lower socioeconomic status and that have a lot of immigrant populations, and bring those kids into the lab in the summer, show them this experience. But also, I think a lot of research has shown when you target these underrepresented groups, it's not enough just to bring them in for a sort of one shot. Here's your chance to reach for the stars. You actually have to have some continuity. And so we're going to have a dedicated mentorship for these students with the opportunity for them to continue to come to the lab if they can, but they will be assigned a mentor. And that mentor will shepherd them through the university application process and help them write their personal statement and evaluate the different universities that are compatible with their needs and, you know, shepherd them through that process, which may be for these kids, you know, they have zero family experience with this. They could be the first person in Germany to attend university from their family. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to have this potential for a long-term mentorship for these kids.
I can see how you inspire so many people on so many different levels. If there's anything you could say to someone in this position or maybe in a better position, but that is aiming to have a career like yours, what piece of advice would you give them?
The one piece of advice that I think has served me well is to follow your, I don't know which body part to use here, your heart, your gut, your mind, follow your passion. I think these days, budding scientists are given a lot of advice about how to prepare your curriculum vitae, how to network, and, you know, all of these sort of soft skills. They're bombarded with soft skill courses and planning and being strategic. But that, I think, comes at the expense of just realizing what got me here. You know, what is the question that really drives me? What fascinates me? What keeps me up at night? What do I wake up from? When I wake up at 2 a.m., what pops into my head? Always following that passion will mean that you will always do your best science. So you're not doing something because someone told you you should go learn this technique.
Yeah.
You're doing something because you love it.
You want it. Yeah.
And this is the only way you can really succeed in science, is to really do what you love. You can see this, you know, the people that you meet who inspire you are the people who have like found something that they love and they're doggedly pursuing it in the face of whatever adversity comes their way. And because it's also so intrinsically enjoyable. I mean, that's the other thing. I'm presenting it as if this will make you successful, but this will also make you happy. You know, this is what makes you happy, is to do something you love. And what an incredible privilege, you know, we have as scientists to have this luxury of spending time every day doing something we love. I mean, sadly, that I cannot say that for most of the population, at least that's my view. Mm-hmm. But I think it's like such an amazing job to discover things and to wonder about a question that has been driving you.
Erin Truman, a passionate scientist who had the great breakthrough with her discovery of proteins in the synapses, that they are produced there rather than in the core of the cell. And I really love talking to you, and I'm already inspired and learned a lot from today's episode. I hope you did too. And I wish you all the best for your continuous work and how you continue to inspire young people and also have a great impact on the research in Frankfurt at the Max Planck Institute. Thank you very much for being with us today, Erin Truman.
Thanks, Diana. It was my pleasure.